Life Takes Guts with Nidhi Swaroop. In 2018, Dharia had symptoms of abdominal discomfort, blood in the stools. She was diagnosed as having moderately severe ulcerative colitis.
Hi Dharia, a very warm welcome to the Crohn's and Colitis Society of Singapore podcast called Life Takes Guts with Nidhi Swaroop. A very warm welcome to you. Hey, hi.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah. So today we thought of, inviting you and hear your experience of living with inflammatory bowel disease. Maybe you can share with us how long ago did you have any kind of symptom that was related to the gut?
Honestly, when I was younger, I didn't really have much gut issues. I was perfectly healthy. This really just started in 2018. So that was the first time I saw symptoms and experienced symptoms that were not very usual. And that's when I realized that I think there's something that I need to check.
So around 5 years ago, you had, what exactly was happening at that time?
So I was actually on an overseas trip. I was in Nepal at that point.
Oh.
Yeah. I think that was the first time that I experienced a very drastic shift in weather conditions. It was quite cold there. Mm-hmm. When I was there, I think the last 2 days that I was there, I started feeling extremely tired, but I didn't think too much of it because mm-hmm. I think fatigue is just like something normal. Towards the end, before, from Nepal, I was going to go to India. So when, right before I went to India, I started experiencing abdominal pains. There was a lot of gas, very weird, but I attributed that to food.
When we're traveling, we're eating at different places, and I suppose it would be like a 10-day kind of trip, or
it was about 2 weeks, so about 14 days.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. 14 days. So right before I flew to India, I went to the washroom, and that's when I noticed drops of blood in my stool. At that time, again, I didn't really think that it was something that I should be worried about. I actually thought it was heat. They call it piles, right? I think.
Yeah.
I thought it was that. Yeah. I called my parents and I told, naturally they asked me how I was, and I told them I am experiencing some changes in my body, but I really think it's just because I'm in a different place right now. I should be fine when I come back.
Mm-hmm. So this was with your friends or college mates, or what kind of a combination of
It was a community service trip, a university community, so I was with my university mates there.
So your parents were still back in Singapore, and this was a conversation over the phone that you are facing something, and they were quite concerned. So did you go and see any doctor in India?
No, I didn't. So in India, when I went, the funny thing is that actually, once I saw drops of blood, it stopped for a few days. So when I went to India, it actually stopped. I was still experiencing gas and abdominal cramps somewhat, but it wasn't so bad to the point where I thought that I needed a doctor. So I didn't go. When I came back to Singapore, then it started to become rapidly worse. So I started to lose a lot of weight because I was going to the toilet, the washroom, maybe 6 to 7 times a day.
That can be exhausting.
Yeah, it was very exhausting. And I guess because of the frequency of washroom, toilet visits, I think I wasn't exactly digesting the food and absorbing the minerals or nutrients. Naturally, I lost a lot of weight, and I was also anemic at some point.
Well, how did you know that you were anemic without getting a test? But you saw a lot of blood, is it going?
I did see a lot of blood, but I did not know for sure I was anemic. I actually found out in a very interesting way. I went to the blood bank to donate blood. Yeah, so they
Despite
reject.
all this, despite all this.
Yes, despite all this, because I was like wondering, like, because there was something that I was doing when I was perfectly fine. So I don't know
Okay.
why, like, this time when I went back,
Yeah.
they rejected me three times, and it was the same receptionist that was there, that particular blood bank. It was at Dhoby Ghaut. And she remembered me the previous two times, and the third time I still did not pass the hemoglobin test.
Oh,
Yeah, so she told me,
interesting.
I do think that you need to visit a doctor because it is not very common to see people coming back with the same like issue.
Yeah, because normally when you go to donate blood and if your hemoglobin is low, they'd actually give you iron tablets to take for a few
They did
months
give
or
me that. Yeah, they did give me
yeah.
that. I took them. I drank H2O. I think that's what they used to give us. So
Okay.
it didn't work, and I was also feeling a certain way. I just felt like I was honestly trying to push away the whole diagnosis thing, and I didn't want to visit the doctor because I just kept telling myself it will go away the next day, it will go away the next day. It didn't.
No, so how much time actually went by like this?
I'll have to admit that this is a fault of mine, but it was almost 6 months before I.
6 months before you saw the doctor. Wow. And did you go to a GP or were you referred immediately to a gastroenterologist?
I went to the GP first. So the GP
Okay.
actually told me that it could be a parasitical issue. So maybe it's a
Some
parasite.
infection, some kind of infection. Okay.
So then he gave me a medicine. Actually, he did suggest that I go to the doctor, the specialist, maybe. But I told him that honestly, the other thing that was in my mind was medical costs. I was not insured. So I knew that, okay, if I went at this point and it is this bad, I may not actually be able to pay for the bills. And then the doctor, he said, okay, you know what? Let's try a very simple medicine first. If it goes away with this, then, good for you. Can avoid the whole thing. So we tried. It did work actually for maybe 1 or 2 weeks. The blood stopped. So I really thought it was just that. Then after that, it came back full force, and I was almost going to faint. That's when my parents brought me to the GP again, the same GP, but this time the GP said, "I'm sorry, I have to send you to the hospital." So he wrote me a, I think, a referral letter or something like that, an emergency referral letter, and he asked me to go directly from the GP to the hospital. So I went to SGH.
Okay. And then what happened there? Were you like admitted straight away?
Yes, I was
Yeah.
it.
And how long were you there? I'm sure there would be a lot of tests and scans. Yeah. So how long were you there?
The first time that I got admitted, it was 7 days, about 1 week. I was
One
there.
week, yes. Yeah. And were you allowed any kind of food or drink at that time, or was it all intravenous? What was the situation?
Just until the scope, they put me on. Like basically, I was fasting. After the scope, they did not really give me a specific diet. They just continued with whatever the hospital was providing.
Okay,
So,
so you had a colonoscopy done and the diagnosis was given to you straight away.
yes.
Okay, so what was the diagnosis in your case?
So he's it was ulcerative colitis.
Colitis. Okay, so the fresh blood, yeah, that sits in with, yeah, it's quite typical in ulcerative colitis patients to have fresh blood coming out when they go to the toilet. So now, after this 1 week when you're sent home, were you still having diarrhea or were you put onto medication and the blood and the diarrhea, what was it all stopped? How were you when you were discharged?
They gave me steroids to go on first because the inflammation was quite bad, even though it was 6 months of like not doing anything. So they gave me steroids, and I think they also gave me immunosuppressants, oral pills first, and then so I was on steroids. It was tapered, and when I was on steroids, actually, I was perfectly fine. It helped a lot. I was also told that I would have like a moon phase, maybe side effects and stuff, but my body took it very well, actually. I didn't have any of those. I was completely fine. My ulcerative colitis was managed, I mean manageable. And yeah, that was the case for maybe about 3 to 4 weeks, about 1 month. After that, it came back in
Was it,
again.
yeah, what was it like, specified by the doctor that it's mild, moderate, or severe kind of ulcerative colitis? Is there that kind of a classification for in your situation?
I don't quite remember exactly, but I think it was about moderately severe.
Moderate to severe. Okay.
Moderate.
So yeah, when it comes to steroids and immunosuppressants, my understanding is that steroids take effect immediately, but immunosuppressants take a little while to kick in. Yeah, so that's why the buffer, and then the steroid is kind of tapered off, and then immunosuppressants continue for longer. Is that how it was?
Yeah, it was. I mean, that was what the doctor told me. I mean,
Plan.
that was what was planned. But I think 1 month in, it was it wasn't so effective.
Oh, is it? Is it? Okay. So, if we can just rewind a little bit, when you are told that you have something called ulcerative colitis, what was going through your mind at that time? Did you ever hear about this kind of a condition?
No, I have never heard of this kind of condition, actually. I mean, I've heard of gastritis, heard of piles, hemorrhoids. I mean, these are the only things that I associate with blood in
Yeah, when we go to the toilet. Yeah, absolutely. So what were you thinking at that time? I mean, there might have been quite a few questions.
Surprisingly, I think I was actually pretty calm about it. I wasn't very anxious. I wasn't very scared. I just took it as it is. I think it's just something that had to happen, and it did. So, at that point, I did not have much. I didn't have much information about ulcerative colitis. So for me, it just meant that I was just told that okay, I had to watch my diet. I had to take medication, and it could be in the long run, so I couldn't, you know, it's not something
That you
that
could
just go
stop.
away like a flu. So that's about it. I was just told that.
So you took it in your stride. So that's very brave of you. Amazing. And yeah. So you're saying, yeah. So you were saying that for about a month it was effective. And then what happened?
After a month, I felt sick again. I don't think I had blood in stool, but I was feeling I had very high fever. Okay, yeah, I had very high fever, and then I was brought to the hospital again because it was really very bad. I think I couldn't even like open my. I was burning. And then you know they admitted me again because they wanted to check whether it is because of my condition or the medicines that I was taking at that point. And then they actually found that my white blood cell count was dangerously low. So they
No.
told me that that was not good, and it was definitely because of the medication that I was the immunosuppressant that I was.
Immunosuppressants. They do bring.
So that's the reason why they took me off that medication. They put me on IV drips, send me home, fine again. But again, they gave me steroids at that point.
Okay.
And
So that
then,
was so the 1 month you were on steroids and it was tapered down, but it had to be restarted. Yeah, is that right? Okay. And yeah, what was it kind of the same level of steroids as in the beginning, or was it higher level? Same. Okay. Okay. And you are still going to the university in this 1 month? You were able to. Okay. That's awesome. So you're able to manage, and then the number of diarrhea, like in the beginning, was like 6 times, and now at this phase of the 1 month, how often did you have to go?
Maybe went down to 2 times, 1 time.
Oh, that's quite manageable, yeah. So with the medication, you are back to the university, you're functioning, but then you have fever suddenly, and was it like you've significantly lost weight in this 1 month?
I was about the same weight. So in that 6 months prior to the diagnosis, I was I lost about 20 kgs.
20.
20,
Oh
yeah.
my God. Oh my God. Yeah.
So I was exactly 68. I was actually on the higher, more bulk side. I was 68 before I got sick, and after I got sick, then I was 48. I still remember
Okay.
that because like the nurse was like, "Wow."
That's huge. Yeah, that's huge. Wow. Okay.
In the
And
1 month,
now
I did not see any change in my
in
weight.
that 1 month. Yeah. I mean, I think you've lost enough in the first 6 months. Yeah. So in this 1 month, I'm trying to understand also on the part of your diet, what changes did you make? I mean, like, did the dietitian visit you and give you some guidance? You know, what was that?
Yes, I was sent to the dietitian actually, and the dietitian basically told me to go on this supplement drink, Ensure.
Okay.
I don't think she told me much about what to avoid or if there was any specific diet to actually stick to. She just told me to do the usual, you know, not eat very spicy food,
Okay.
junk, very oily food.
Yeah.
Other than that, she did not really recommend anything
Nothing
that.
on fiber, nothing on fiber.
No, she did. I mean, she mentioned, she said that if I took more fiber during a flare, it means, you know, it could actually result in more diarrhea. She did say, however, that, you know, it is still important for me to get fiber in because that also bulks up your stool. And time, I guess. I learned how to manage that better because I learned how to see it more.
Okay. So you are able to go to the university, you're able to have your normal diet, plus you're supplementing it with a nutritional drink. And then you're not losing any more weight. At least you're steady. That's the situation, right? So awesome.
But I would like to say that I was actually still very tired.
Tired. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease, and tell me about being fatigued. Absolutely. And it's very difficult to explain to a layperson or another person who is not going through any kind of like chronic fatigue or any other kind of chronic illness, because most people would say, hey, you know, if you're tired, why don't you just rest? And the rest doesn't help. It helps to some extent. Yeah, the body feels a bit rested, but the feeling of fatigue is almost like you're carrying a boulder attached to your chest or abdomen or someplace like that, and you're just dragging yourself all around the place, right? And it never goes away, no matter how much we rest.
Yes, correct.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's a big challenge. And many times I used to say that, how about if we have a little light bulb here to say how tired I am? Yeah, because the face can't show it. And you choose to smile and you want to be normal. It's very difficult. You don't want to be miserable in front of your colleagues, in front of your classmates, yeah? So it's very, very challenging. And then I'm sure it affected your social life. You know, you're a student, and then what happened at that point? You know, can you recall something?
So when I got diagnosed, it was my first year of university. And I would say the first 2 years, so it mine is a 4 years course, right? So the first 2 years I really struggled a lot, really a lot, because and I didn't think that that would be my university life, because I mean I think when you start university, the one time you're gonna enjoy life, like that's what you would
You would
expect.
expect,
But the first 2 years I couldn't, I was not really not able to function at my optimal level because it took me a lot more effort to get the same work done as someone who did not have this condition. So social life wise, I definitely missed out on a lot of things that I would have liked to be part of. Because of the fatigue, I was worried that, you know, if anything happened to me during the period, you know, in whatever event that I would be at, it would be quite embarrassing. But embarrassing aside, I think embarrassment aside, I think I didn't want to really like burden anybody. I didn't want someone else to actually take care of me during that event because they needed to have fun. I mean, that was meant to be fun.
fun thing. Yeah,
So
absolutely.
I think I kind of pulled out of things like that. But to be very honest, as painful as it was, I was not really, I wouldn't say I was too affected by the lack of that kind of social life, because at the same time, I had very good friends, may not be into the university itself, but outside, that I could really just do other things that accommodated my needs. And, and everybody had fun. So we would just chill at home.
Can you give some examples? Like what were the alternatives that you were able to manage?
We would just hang out at home, have movie nights. We would go to the park and do potluck, bring stuff. And my friends were so nice because they always made sure that whatever they cooked and brought was something that I could consume safely. And so they would ask me, "Hey, can you have this?" And I think kombucha was like the one thing that they would bring no matter, because people drink, right? Like it's
Yes.
a whole thing. So they would just bring themselves drinks, but for me, they would bring like kombucha, and they'll be like, "Okay, this is the closest thing to booze that you'll get, but anyway, have fun." So,
So
yeah,
nice of them.
yes,
Yeah.
nice. So I never felt that, and because of this group of people, I never felt that I really missed out on that much.
That's so fortunate. Yeah. So,
Very
yeah. These kind of friends are like forever because,
possible.
yeah, because they totally get you. Yeah. So that support is very important. Can we touch a little bit on your parents' response to such a diagnosis? How did they, respond to it?
So my parents, my mother was actually a lot more strong, not in the sense that she didn't care about me, but more like she took it in a very like, okay, this has happened, now let's look forward, let's not be sad in front of her and show her that we are also very concerned, because that's not going to help her. My dad was very emotional because I'm more attached to my dad, and he is to me as well. So I think the first time I got diagnosed and I was in the hospital, he was like really crying, and he was, yeah, so he was very affected.
Fathers and daughters
Yeah,
are
father and
always,
daughter.
have that special bond. Yeah, absolutely.
And he was actually working overseas for a very long time. And then when he came back to see me when I was diagnosed and all these things, right, he looked at me and he constantly blamed himself, because he said, "I was not here to take care of you. I didn't care about your diet. I didn't give your mother and you enough support. That's why this has happened, etc., etc." And then I had to tell him honestly, certain things you just cannot expect and you cannot avoid, because it's just meant to happen. And it was not because of you. So I had to give him that constant assurance. And I remember my mother was telling him, "Stop doing that, stop doing that." She's already in that stage, like in that state. We don't want to scare her anymore. We just have to be strong for her. So that's
But it's understandable from a parent's perspective, isn't it, that people will try to figure out what caused it.
Oh
But
yeah.
we all know that, neither do the doctors nor do the researchers have an answer for such a thing, that what causes the illness is not known.
Not
Yeah.
known.
And then on the other hand, we don't have like you take this medicine and you'll be fine after 5 days or 2 months or 2 years, nothing like that, right? It's just a management of the illness. So yeah, it's only fair for parents to start thinking what caused it and could I have prevented it? I
Absolutely.
personally went through all that, a lot of questions in my head that was there something I could have done? But then, clearly there is no answer. So we just have to take it in our stride. And you were a perfect example of just, let's hear what the diagnosis is and let's move on. That's absolutely brave of you. So we are looking at, the social aspect which affected, and then the physical is kind of under control with the medication. And so it's been 5 years. Along the way, anything majorly changed or it continued like that for a while?
After the first year, and the first phase of medication and treatment, honestly, every time I went, I think I went back to the hospital maybe 7 to 8 times in total. In
You
the first,
mean you were hospitalized for 7, 8 times in 1 year?
No, not in 1 year. After the first year, I mean,
After the
including the first year's admission, I think in total in the first 3 to 4 years, I was hospitalized at least 7 to 8 times.
7 to 8 times. And what was happening every time?
So it was a flare up. Every time it was a flare up. But sometimes I
Okay.
would say it was not really just the medication's fault. It was also my fault because I was not very compliant. It happens because I think once you start seeing
Some
improvement,
improvement.
you start to become a little bit more complacent. And when you do that, you know, I am on the younger side, right? So when I go out with my friends and all, I think sometimes I just eat stuff that I know I shouldn't, and I could be taking a risk, but I just do it because it's like something that I feel.
The tongue craves it,
Yeah, the tongue
something like
craves.
that. Yeah. So
So
can you list a couple of things that you feel very strongly that you could correlate that, oh, I ate this thing and I had a flare up. Yeah,
yeah.
there are some.
Yes, definitely. Pizzas, pizza, pasta, basically anything that had dairy in it. It was almost like an instant.
Oh, so dairy products were the one that caused. So at home, you wouldn't take any dairy product when you were eating at home. Okay, understand. Wow. So this is when you, okay, for the benefit of those who are listening in and are not familiar with Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, maybe it'll be good to elaborate what we mean by a flare up. What exactly happens in a flare up? So maybe in your case, you could just share what was happening.
So there are a couple of things. I think first I would see a significant decrease in energy level. And it's something you can just tell. It's not something I can really describe in words. But if I were to, then I think the only way I can say it is you'll just really notice that your fatigue is just one of a kind. It's not the same one that you would feel doing other things. The next thing is you'll see for Crohn's, I think it's a little bit different for, but I'll speak for ulcerative colitis. You will more often than not see blood. It will come out with your stool, and right before you see blood, you will start to experience diarrhea. And this diarrhea,
How many?
for me, I think it went up. The highest number of times I actually went to the washroom once was 23 times. I counted that 23
23 times in how
a
many
day.
hours? In 1 day. So literally every hour. I mean,
Yes.
if kind of, oh my
And
God.
each time you would go, it wouldn't be the same amount or consistency. It would just be very different. Sometimes you would go and
Urgency.
it, yeah. So it's incontinence. You would just feel like you need to run, but when you go there, sometimes there's nothing, but there's always a lot of gas. Somehow there's always a lot of gas. So that happens, and then you'll start to notice blood. Eventually it will come, and you know it's gonna come because you will actually feel a very dull kind of pain, pulling pain near your lower back.
Oh.
I mean, near the anus, basically.
Anus, yeah, absolutely.
So you would know that, okay, it's happening. That's
Yeah, so that would be a sign for you that blood is next. Yeah.
yes.
Oh my
And it
God.
almost always, I think, if not, it's always as I predicted. So I would
You
know that.
knew, you could anticipate that this is going to happen. And that's when you go to A&E, is it? And how is the experience? Because you're already diagnosed with ulcerative colitis. And then when you go into A&E, what happens next? Are you there for a very long time, or it becomes like an autopilot? They know exactly what has to happen.
It's autopilot. So I think the first time was a bit longer, but after that, subsequently, I think they knew that, you know, I was a quite a regular patient, and the doctor that was assigned to me was, you know, he knew what I was going through, what I was on, so he didn't really have to.
Yeah,
So
it
he knew.
doesn't take very long. Yeah. So, what happens in that kind of a case that you were on steroids and immunosuppressants And I mean, initially, of course, steroids were reduced, then they were reintroduced. And now, when you're going in and out, you know, like 7, 8 times you have described, was there a change? Did you have to go on another type of medication or just increased dosage?
Yeah, so I had to go on several different types of medication before I finally found the one that really worked. I mean, now it's working, so I'll come to that. But in the last, you know, during the period that really nothing worked, I think I changed about 4 to 5 different types of medication. So first, I was on an oral immunosuppressant. I was escalated to biologics, and I think 2 to 3 different types of biologics. Before they said that, you know, even this is not working, and then they put me on another medication, which is it's an immunosuppressant again, back to oral, and so I'm on that now.
Okay, so just immunosuppressants now.
I'm on mesalazine as well.
Okay, so no more biologics though. Yeah, because I'm thinking about the pyramid. Yeah, when it comes to medication, there's a pyramid, right? We go from mesalazine to steroid, immunosuppressant, and biologics.
Yes.
So, and then what I hear from some patients is they're very scared of going on to biologics because they do not realize that actually there is a possibility of coming down also from the pyramid. Yeah, not just going up, there's also the downward thing. Yeah. So you are an example of such a case where from biologics you're now on immunosuppressants and on mesalazine. Yeah, fantastic. So how long have you been on this for, managing your UC? And maybe I would also like to ask if there was a possibility of surgery, was that also discussed with you?
Yeah, so I think one of the flare-ups when it was, I don't really remember which one it was, but there was one that was particularly bad. So the doctor did say, you could, it's not a necessity at this point because we can still try other medication, but if it is affecting you and your quality of life to this extent, then maybe you can consider surgery, which means that's basically the only cure that you can
Yeah,
have.
because in ulcerative colitis, when there's surgery, the whole large intestine is removed, right? And then there's a little pouch, right, for controlling the fecal matter. Yeah, so that is like the ultimate for ulcerative colitis. But you didn't need that. You didn't need surgery. Yeah.
Needed, I was just told to consider it, but it was left to me like to decide, and I decided against it because I think for me, I still think that I could overcome this, and it was just a matter of time. I needed to be a bit more patient, and so it did work.
It worked. Yeah. I'm like so happy for you that you thought of it, you tried, and you gave it a shot, and it did work. So that's amazing. Staying positive really, really helped. Yeah. So going forward, I'm just wondering if you have any kind of a thought when it comes to another person who's just diagnosed with this condition, just told that, oh, you're, it could be a parent who's listening today. And the child has been diagnosed with ulcerative colitis, or it could be an adult, a young adult. Any message for such a person?
I would say honestly, it is gonna be a it's not gonna be an easy journey for sure. If you're a caretaker, I think it's honestly a little bit harder for you because you're seeing someone else go through this and you're not able to do anything much. Like, you feel helpless. But I would like to say to both the caretakers and the patients who've just been diagnosed that you will come to a stage where you will overcome that. And everyone's experience is very different. But I would also like to say that before you, there were many people who've gone through what you're going through right now. You're not alone. You're not alone. So even, it's not just doctors that are supporting you. It's not just the nurses, not just the hospitals. You have a community outside that's waiting for you, that's going to take care of you and be a support for you. It really helped me a lot. I know when you're going through this whole flare-up, it's very painful, and everyone is different. So you will learn how to overcome your own challenges your own way. But once you feel that you're ready, I think the best thing you would do for yourself is really to find people who are going through what you're going through. And then you will know that it is a, it's just normal. We are still humans. We are still capable of a lot of things. It just takes us a little bit longer because now we have something else to walk with, but it's not a challenge.
That's a very powerful message, Daria. Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts. And you brought out a very important point also, which maybe we can talk a little bit, a minute maybe, that each person is different. This is something that I had to learn very quickly because the doctor did tell me also, as a Crohn's disease patient, my question was, what do I eat or don't eat? Please tell me. And the response was, you need to figure out for yourself. And as lay people, I think we get quite a shocker that the doctor's not giving me the answer, but is asking me to figure it out. It's not easy, but I just used a Excel table for 6 months and I just recorded everything that I ate for breakfast, lunch, snack, and dinner. And then besides that, I also recorded feelings and symptoms. So it's called a food feelings and symptoms diary. And this was very helpful in my case to identify what doesn't suit my body. So similarly, other people figure out, it takes a while because let's say today I have some abdominal discomfort, then I have to look at the last 3 days what I have eaten. And something in there is the trigger. So that kind of a formula was helpful when I heard about it. So, but doing that takes some level of discipline and consistent input of information to figure out. So if it's a parent or someone who's caring for a patient can do this kind of a recording, or if the patient himself or herself can do it, it'll be fantastic. So that's one way of, taking back some level of control. The illness isn't easy, and it kind of makes us feel we've lost all control over ourselves, but we have to find a way. We really have to find a way. And you're very right that there are others out there. Like in Singapore, now we have around 3,000 patients, and from all ages, be it children, young adults, seniors, everyone. So we are all in this together. And when people can come together, there's a lot of learning and sharing.
Yes.
Even to know that I'm not alone is a big deal, isn't it? So
You
we've
would.
known each other like maybe 2 years, and it's like, wow, we are family now. So any last message before we wrap up today's session?
No, I'm good.
You're good. I think you'd be quite an inspiration for many young people out there because you've taken things in your stride in a very brave way. So congratulations to you. I'm almost stumbling.
I maybe like one thing that I would like to say is I'm not sure if it's the right time, but I'm really thankful for you. And I'm thankful that you came up with this. I mean, you founded this organization, and despite having a lot of challenges in keeping it going, you made it such a success because without that, I would have been pretty lost if you ask me. And I hope that it continues to be a source of support for a lot more people to come. Of course, I'm not hoping that they will get diagnosed with this, but they're
Yes,
better off not being. But if they do,
whoever.
and I just want them to know that it's not the end of anything. You seeing you do things like this inspires me because you're a patient yourself and you've gone through a lot. You don't actually have to do this if you didn't want to, but you are doing it. And there are many people like that that I've met during my course of being, part of this community where you see these patients don't let their conditions limit them. They're achieving so many things in life, continuing to take care of their families, being there with their friends, having fun, laughing, smiling. And I think maybe new patients will gain some hope from all that.
Absolutely, absolutely. That is such a powerful word that you have used. Hope is something that I always like to bring to others. That, I mean, without hope, I think we are nowhere. We will just spiral downwards. Whereas, like you said, everyone has some talent and you can use that to bring it forward. But of course, the fatigue part brings us down, slows us down, but then it also makes us more efficient in managing time. So we do the best we can and find our way with these challenges. And I'm sure we have a bright future. I'm sure we can help scientists, we can help clinicians bring our lived experience and then find more, maybe new medicines or new devices that can measure our pain, that can measure our fatigue. So it's easier to explain to people, like if we have a fever, we use a thermometer and that's it. We can tell and people get it. But it's not the case when it comes to pain or fatigue. So hopefully going forward, we can all, arm up together with other stakeholders and find better solutions so that quality of life of all patients is better in the future. So thank you so much for your time and
Thank
all the best going forward.
you.
Take
You too.
care. Thank
Yeah.
you. Bye-bye.
We hope you found today's conversation useful and we look forward to you joining us in the next episode. For more information about joining the patient support group, please contact the Crohn's and Colitis Society of Singapore. You can reach us via email at admin@ibd.org.sg or WhatsApp at +65 9756 4066. Do visit our website www.ibd.org.sg to know more about our annual seminar, financial assistance schemes, and how you could join us as a member, meet other patients, as well as parents of children living with IBD. This educational and public awareness project is kindly supported by the National Youth Council, Singapore.